Welcome to Engage 360, Denver Seminary's podcast. Join us as we explore the redemptive power of the gospel and the life-changing truth of Scripture at work in our culture today.
Friends, welcome to Engage 360. This is Denver Seminary's podcast, and we are very glad that you've chosen to spend some time with us. I'm Don Payne, your host for this episode, and we are delighted today to have a conversation with Jamie Nato. Jamie is an author, a speaker, a blogger, a serial entrepreneur, a coffee shop owner, a pickle farmer, and a black belt in cornhole.
There's nothing else to say after that. I mean, you pretty much know.
All there is that's worth knowing about you. I have yet to see any empirical evidence of the those last two claims, the pickle farmer and the black belt in cornhole, but those are the claims, and so I'll let them stand without evidence.
Well, I hope I get to see you in a couple weeks, and I hope to destroy you in cornhole.
Okay. Well, as long as you bring pickles, then that might be allowed, but we'll see. We'll see. So in 2023, Jamie released her book, This Must Be the Place, Following the Breadcrumbs of Your Past to Discover Your Purpose Today. This was put out by Bethany House. So as we start talking about this, Jamie, give us your elevator speech of what the book is about. And then I want to know why you wrote it and who you wrote it for. But what's the elevator speech?
Well, I think I noticed that I got a little bit lost along the way in my own identity as I'm a mom and I'm a wife, and that's who I am. Of course, I'm a believer, but I really got stuck in that as my identity. And I didn't have much else to, like, even hobbies, or I kind of went all in on mothering and wifing. And I think because the faith space that I was in said, this is where you go all in, and you are nothing else but these things. And so I really believed that. And I got lost. I got lost along the way because, you know, heartache comes into your life when it wants to. And so there's a piece of my story that involves infidelity. And I thought, okay, I'm getting a divorce. I must not be a good wife. I'm so embarrassed. So if I'm not a good wife and probably not a good mom because I'm so sad right now, then who am I? I mean, it really flipped my world upside down. So you're like, give us an elevator pitch. I'm like, should we talk about infidelity? But that was the point in my faith and in my relationship with God where I realized I'm not just a mom and a wife. Like, I need to go back and see who God made me to be. And so I think my hope in this book is that women get a giant permission slip, and even you, Don, you get a giant permission slip to really look at your story, look back at your story, evaluate, kind of like ruminate on these stories that make up your life and say, hey, I don't think this stuff is an accident. And I don't think this part of my story is a waste. And I think God is a great reframer. And so I hope, that's what I think the Bible is, that he takes these things that are weird and awful and crazy and miraculous and or funny, and he reframes them in light of his grand story. And so this is just a permission slip for women to, I tell a story, I go first, and then I ask them to reflect on their life. And I think if you really do look back and you reflect and you reframe and kind of see that things are interconnected and not coincidental, that it gives you a big, big permission slip to live intentionally. And I don't think a lot of us are living intentionally. I think it's like things happen to us and we're reacting and we're spending like 8 hours on our phone, like scrolling. And I think there's a better way.
That's really well said. And you kind of answered the question about who you wrote it for, because what I hear, Jamie, is that lots of people are in the same space.
Yeah.
Caught in the randomness of life as it to use your words, as it just kind of happens to us, and we get in this habitual reactionary mode without seeing that there's any kind of pattern there.
We're looking at, I think we know a lot about other people's lives. As women especially, we know a lot about our kids' lives. We know a lot about our spouse, his life. We know a lot about our friends' lives. We care for and nurture other people's lives and stories. But when it comes to our own, I have noticed women are not looking back and making sense of their stories and really nurturing some of those things that need attention. And even some of those things that you would say, that was just bad and I've moved on. Like, that was just bad and now I've moved forward. And I think I want to help you kind of dig around and say, like, maybe what I buried there is, like, that has some treasure. So, like, I buried that and said it was dead, but I wonder if there's something there that could give you life.
You mentioned women, and I know it's not exclusive to women, but I think you do have mostly women in view here. Why does it seem that women may struggle with that so much? Are there just too many things coming at them from too many angles, and they just get caught up in these demands and needs of others? And
I think so. I think it's really, really easy to be distracted. And that doesn't mean just by your phone. I mean, I think the just daily, mundane, whatever it is that but there is something also there about women not feeling like they can dream about something that's not their family, or dream of something that isn't family oriented. So maybe you're single and you've been told, like, just get married and have kids. And that just isn't everybody's story. And it cannot be the pinnacle. It cannot be the climax of your life. Because, and Don, you know this too, like, inside of marriage and being a parent, it will let you down, right? And it's great too, but it's not where we put our hope. So I think there's something there. There's a block that women don't think that they can dream about something else. And then I think, like, life is just distracting. I also think it's hard work. Like, if you're going to look back, you're going to encounter some things that you've already kind of, like, moved on from. And I think it's hard work to pay attention to your story.
It may even be a skill that has to be honed. And one thing I appreciated about your book is that you do it in a way that it seems to give a model of how to hone that skill of looking at your story. Because I don't know that that's a natural or easy thing for many people to do.
I've grown up just reframing. I don't know if your people do Enneagram. I'm a 7, and so I'm going to be constantly reframing things. And I have, like, severe ADHD, as you well know, but as a student, as a squirrel student. But there's those things that just make you. And so I've grown up reframing constantly, like, how do I make sense of that? And once I realized, I love stories. I like telling stories. As you know, you gave me a B on my first paper, and I didn't know if you have it, if you wanted to repent for that publicly or if I'm getting
I wasn't going to bring that up.
Yes, I
didn't know it's still a I didn't know it's still a sore spot. But go ahead.
It's a sore spot, okay. And since we're talking about the past,
that's a breadcrumb.
It's a breadcrumb of me not following instructions, and you're, like, real entertaining. You also did not follow instructions, but lesson learned. But, you know, I've been reframing. And when I look at the Bible and I look at what the Bible is, it is a bunch of stories. And the stories are told over and over and over again. And I think because stories are so powerful, I think, and I talk about this in the book, but when you start telling a story, your brain, whoever's listening, lights up in different ways. And we want to listen to a story. So I think the Bible is a bunch of stories that are constantly being reframed in light of, you know, what Jesus did for us. And I think if we go back and look at our stories, I mean, there's funny things that have happened to me. I mean, I work in a space of like comedy, which your listeners right now are thinking like, she's actually kind of intense and has some sad stories. But I work in like, you know, funny space. And I think even that, when I look back on why I love humor and why I love laughing and how that came to be, it makes sense. Like with my childhood and growing up poor, and you don't have a lot of resources, so you're making entertainment, like, you know. So I think all of those things come together and make sense. And the point is that you reframe them in light of like who God is.
Even, you know, even for those who may not be intuitive reframers like you are, the way you do that, I think gives people a vision for that as a possibility, that my life and all these, to use your metaphor, the breadcrumbs, these random breadcrumbs, they can be reframed. Even if it's not a natural or intuitive thing for people, as it may be for you, I find that to be one of the most hopeful things about the book. And I love the way you tell your stories. Now, I did notice your disaffection for capitalization, which reminds me of Cormac McCarthy's writing style. But that aside, the stories really are wonderful. And you, let me just say that, as cliche as it is these days to say that with God nothing gets wasted, I think your story overall and your stories are a really vivid version of that truth, that with God nothing gets wasted. That I was reminded of that over and over as I read through your stories. And what I wanted to say about your stories is that they really are a quite creative example, for me anyway, of how to make our stories available to others and beneficial to others. Because stories can be interesting, they can be entertaining, but you do have a really interesting way of making your stories beneficial to others.
Yeah, I think the stories are, I think, the most important thing about us. And so, because God put these stories in us, right? And you're living them out. You're living out these breadcrumb moments and you don't even know it. And of course God does, but it's, you know, when you're living it out, it's like, oh, am I going the right way? Am I doing this the right way? Who knows if I'm going the right direction? I rely on old faith sometimes. So I look back on stories where I see God showed up for me there. He really did show up for me there. And that was on purpose. I couldn't see it. So that now when I'm going through something that feels dark, I remember that God restored my marriage. Like, it was miraculous. And so now I'm facing something hard in this area. And I say, no, we're not going to lose hope, because remember what God did for you over here. And so those stories, we bear witness to them, right? So when you tell a story, I get to bear witness to that, which is almost as powerful, maybe more powerful than someone telling the story. Because now I feel like that's like deep calling to deep. And so I think it's important. I think it really matters that we stop hiding our stories in shame, being embarrassed about the way things went, just telling the truth. And you'd be surprised at how many people say, me too.
Yeah.
That happened to me too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for those who haven't read your book, and I do want people to read your book, give maybe just an example of or two of the stories and how those breadcrumbs work together into something really significant for you. Give people an example of what you're talking about.
Well, one of my favorite stories is, I grew up next door to a severely disabled kiddo, and her name was Hannah. And this was a normal part of our life. We would take Hannah. This is Texas. It's the Wild Wild West, you know, and it was the 80s. But we would take Hannah out of her wheelchair and we would put her in what we called the bucket, which was a bucket with wheels. And we would wheel her around the neighborhood, just going on adventures with Hannah. We would put her in a horse trough with us and do the world. I don't know if you know that you run in one direction, a bunch of you, and then it creates this whirlpool. And then you kind of sit and get carried in a rusty horse. And I have an incredible immune system. Okay.
You must by now.
And by now I'm just shining. And so, you know, we grew up, it was just normal for us to be around Hannah. And then when my dad went to law school, he decided he's going to go to law school in his late 30s with six kids. And he tells people he was in the Texas prison system, but he worked in the Texas prison system as a counselor, is what they call them. So there's like a justice system inside of the prison, but you don't have to be a real attorney to be a counselor. You're kind of a mediator. And my dad was like, I keep winning all my cases in prison. And so he decided he is going to be an attorney. Well, he goes to law school and he sits in the front row with Clay, and Clay is blind. He has, he can hardly hear. So he has these big, like, hearing aids in, and he has glass eyeballs, and ask me how I know. Because my dad would bring Clay over and for dinner, and Clay was like Rain Man. And so this is before we had Google, but I had reports to do. Okay. And so I would say, Clay, he had this memory. Clay, what happened? What happened in August 13th, 1981? And he used shake back and forth, and he'd be like, August 13th, 1981. Okay, that was when. He would tell me what president it was, what was going on, like everything that was happening. And so we just loved Clay. We grew up and we did teach him to drive once. And in hindsight, that is not safe, but it was just a John Deere buggy. So, and he changed our lives in a sense that it was just very common for me to be around people who are differently abled. So fast forward to my own life and my own motherhood story, and I have a differently abled child, severely developmentally delayed. And when I looked back at my story, because I kept saying, like, God, I don't think I'm not the right mom for this. Like, I don't have the skills for this. I don't know what to do. And frankly, I'm a little disappointed in the dreams that I had for her, and those aren't going to come true. So there's like, and then I feel bad about that. So I think when I was talking to God about that, the memories that popped up was Hannah and Clay, and God saying essentially like, you know how to do this. This, look at your breadcrumbs. Like you, this is going to be, it's not that it's not going to be difficult, but you know how to do this. And I think it just gave me confidence, like, you know what? God put these people in my life to not only make my life better, but for my future. Like, I feel really equipped, and I feel really, like, blessed. That sounds kind of cheesy, but that Lila is in our life, and she makes our life better. And the dreams that I had pale in comparison to the joy that she brings us. So, I mean, that's just one example, and that was kind of long.
You know, but that does show how these dots connect. Even if they connect over long spaces, they really do connect.
Yeah, I believe it. I really believe it. I think everybody can find those dots, find those breadcrumbs. And if you do that, I think you will find a lot of purpose and a lot of confidence that God has equipped you. Yeah. You have what you need.
Well, that's one thing I loved about the way you tell those stories, Jamie, is that underneath what is a collage of quirky, hilarious, extemporaneous experiences, underneath all that, there really is a thickness, a gravity that runs pretty deep underneath your journey. And it sounds like that really anchors your journey. What was the process of writing this book like for you, of recalling, recapturing all these stories, pulling these dots together, and then showing readers what God has brought and is bringing out of all that? What's that process like for you?
Well, I tried to write a different book before. I had publishers since I was blogging and I was talking about infidelity, and a lot of people weren't. Publishers were like, hey, you should write a book about infidelity. And so I wrote maybe like 8 chapters of it, and I hated it. I hated writing that book. But I had heard writers say writing a book is hard and it's torturous. And so I'm like, I guess this is how it's supposed to be. And I think it was because it was the wrong book. But and I just felt like I kept hitting a wall every time. And then I would be mad at my husband. And he's like, oh, you were writing today, you know, and I'm just digging up all this old stuff. I'm like, maybe stay out of the house for 2 days. But I let it go. I just thought I didn't look at it in the middle of it. I wasn't like, oh, this is a breadcrumb. This is not the book you're supposed to write. This is one chapter. Like my life, I am not the lady who forgave her husband and now their marriage is restored. Like that's a part of my story, but my life is complicated and layered, and there's good things too and funny things. And so I thought, if I could just write a book of essays that someone could pick up, you don't even have to read it all the way through. Like you can, it needs to be an easy read and not in a sense that it's not going to make you think, but I want it to be enjoyable for the reader. And unlike some of our academic things that we have to read, Don, but anyways,
I'm just going to let that go, but go ahead, man.
I mean, yours were all good.
Well, clearly.
But yeah, I think so. When I started writing this book, I loved it. I wrote it so fast. I would write half a chapter in a day, the next chapter the next day, then send it to my editor. She would tidy it up. Not that I needed a lot. Yes, I did. But you know what? Breadcrumb moment, Dawn. All those red lines on that paper, I mean, my editor, you know, they tear it up. At first you look at it and you think, I'm the worst writer in the universe. And then you think, oh, they're just making me better. And so when it comes to writing academic papers, you learn to appreciate the critique so that you're better the next time.
Okay.
But you know what? I was just all that to say, like, I loved writing this book. And I think if your listeners are trying to, maybe they have a dream of writing a book, sit your butt in the chair, sit down and write, and just write as long as you can. So, I mean, maybe that's not going to work for everyone, but for a squirrel like me, that worked.
Well, you know, sometimes in a writing project, even if we know, or we think we know what we're going to write before we sit down to start writing,
right,
or we wouldn't sit down to write, the writing process itself discloses things we did not know that we knew. In other words, we learn more about our own story. We learn more about what it is we think by having to write it down, and we didn't know that before we started. Did that happen to you at all?
It happens every time. I think, oh, I'm going to write about this, and then it's something completely different. And I say, I didn't even know that was in there, but it needed to come out. But writing is simply, I think writing is reflecting. If you are going to sit down and write something, and academic or not, you are reflecting on a piece of whatever. And I think even if you're not a good writer, like writing your story is important, and women in particular need to take up more space with their stories. So if you really do answer the questions, that my secret hope that I didn't tell my publishers was that you would have your own little memoir, and it doesn't need to be well-written, but if you answer those questions, you're going to have some meat that it's really important to bear witness to.
Well, I think that bears witness to the case you're making in the book. That is part of the breadcrumb trail that comes together.
Yeah.
You know, Jamie, even though you did not intend this to be a theologically academic book, I can't help doing this, I was paying attention to the theological underpinnings of what you were doing. And I picked up on some really good theology that was was driving this from underneath. Can I tell you what I appreciated theologically about your book?
I will take any compliments about theology for that. So.
Well, here's what I picked up on from your book, that even if God is not mechanically orchestrating all the moves and the pieces of our lives, God is present to us and God is present to those pieces in ways that make patterns and meaning out of them.
Yes.
I think that's what I heard you saying. I think also you're helping people see the more factor in their lives, helping us not buy into these reductionistic myths of our culture that there's more involved behind and in the seemingly benign or pedestrian pieces of our lives, because God is always creating.
Right.
God did not simply create things and set them in motion and let them go. God is always creating. And we, in our own small, finite way, we get to participate in his ongoing creative process by picking up on the more factor.
Yeah.
And I love that.
It's like you're saying more, even when you think he's done, like even when I think I'm healed, like say in my marriage, I think, oh, I've really done the work to heal and God's done this miracle. Every year, God finds something that I've tucked away in my heart and he says, and now we're going to heal this little tiny thing.
Another layer.
Like, what are you like that you care about that detail that I just was like, oh, that doesn't matter.
I picked out a number of statements you made from your book, and I'd love to just read them back to you and have you reflect on them if you care to. On page 10, and I love the way you said this, when you pair a unique empathy with a unique gifting, you find your calling.
Yeah. I 100% believe that.
You said it. I hope you do.
Like,
believe
that is
that
so
sounds like
wise.
You, doesn't it?
That is brilliant. No, I really, it's one of my favorite sentences in the book. It matters so much. So when you take, I think empathies come a lot out of like heartache. I think your heart aches for something, either because you've experienced this in some way, or maybe God has just given you the gift of like unique empathy for a certain something. But man, pairing that with your gifts is a rocket ship. And I wish that we would pay attention to our empathies a little bit more because of that.
Love that. Here's the second quote that I picked out that I want to read back to you, though I'll preface it by saying that in my theology classes, I have often said to students, and I need to say to listeners, I say this tongue in cheek, okay, so nobody's heresy bells go off. I do believe in the omnipotence of God, but I do think there's one, tongue in cheek, there's one thing God cannot do, and that's draw a straight line. And you pick up on that. Yeah, I thought I was pretty witty in that, but then I've realized, oh, you said this too. A straight line would not allow us to see our need for God's mercy and his tender guidance as we brave our tenuous journey. Say more about
and
that.
And it's also really, really boring to have a straight line.
Like, yeah.
You know, I talk about if there's a movie and it was like, look, she was born and then she crushed it. That is the worst movie of all time. No one would want to listen to that. There's something in us that I really think it calls back to eternity, which says like, you can overcome this. Like it seems dead and then we're going to get life. It seems like there's no way out of this. And then God breaks through. I think we're always looking for the underdog. I think that's just eternally in us in that very not straight line.
You have a great line when you're talking about your daughter. You call her a doctor who fixes my broken perspective and a teacher who teaches me a better way to love and accept and dream.
That kind of makes me teary. And you know, I like to cry in every class. You love that a lot. I thought this child, I'm going to teach this child how to survive in this weird world and I'm going to protect her And I'm just going to make her life, you know, as good as it can be. I was just so wrong. I'm so blown away by how she joyfully teaches me that there's a different way and it doesn't look like my way. She, like right now, she's outside with these huge headphones on, yodeling. She has discovered yodeling. And so she goes in our front yard and scream yodeled. And she's 15 and she's dancing while she's doing it too. But wild abandon.
Good for her.
Just doesn't care. And I'm looking at her like, I could use a little bit of that. Not yodeling. I don't.
But the abandon.
Think we should. But the wild abandon. But no, without the yodeling.
Okay, last quote. Now, this one's just a little bit longer, but it's from toward the end of your book. You say, it doesn't matter how much personal development I might do, how much I mature and age, how much I think I'm relying on Christ. On this side of heaven, I will continually have opportunities to find my way back to Him. I will desperately need to find my identity in Christ over and over. Now, Jamie, I found that curiously liberating personally, especially that last part that we have to keep finding our identity in Christ over and over. Tell me why I find that so liberating, if you can.
Well, does it not just give humans a permission slip to just not have it all together all the time? And I certainly don't, as we all know, but that God put something in us that we would need, that we would keep needing Him, that otherwise, if everything goes the way that I want it to go, and I find this often, things are good and I don't need God as much. And what I'm missing out in that, in not, you know, suffering or in hardship, what I'm missing out is His nearness, in a sense of God is near to the brokenhearted. And I am often jealous of myself in those times, like when my marriage was falling apart, where I really felt like God's breath was on my neck. And I call it spooning with Jesus, but my sister says I can't say that anymore. So that's the last time I'm going to say it. But I felt so close, like Jesus was there. And you cannot, that feeling and that nearness and His presence is better than getting what I want, getting my marriage back or having my life perfect or having a kiddo who's just like everybody else or whatever. It's His presence and His nearness was the reward, not the thing I thought I wanted.
Well, I have to tell you, Jamie, I think your book is one of the more hopeful things I have read in quite some time. Thank you for the gift.
That makes me happy. And I think your listeners should know that this is a pink book. That
it is. And if they're watching the video version of this, here it is.
And this,
the pink book sat on my desk for
so happy to think about this sitting on your desk with all your academic books and your bright little light pink book.
But you have alluded a few times to grades and the reading that you may not have enjoyed as much. You're part of a women's leader cohort here at Denver Seminary. How did that show up on your breadcrumb trail?
I finished this book and then you launch it and I was looking around like, this has never happened to me. I usually always have a lot of plate spinning and I know what I'm going to do and I'm a dreamer and I had nothing. And I kept praying like, this is such a weird feeling. What do I do? And then my friend said, hey, we should go to seminary together. And without even looking at any documents or, you know, saying like, how long is the program and what even is the degree? I said yes and got wrangled into this cohort, but it has been one of the best things I've ever done. I wish I would have done it earlier, but you know, you can't go back. And it has been one of the most formative activities that I've ever done. And I think I didn't expect I wanted to learn. I love to be like very, I like information and I like to be mentally stimulated, but I don't think I expected that I would love God so much more than when we started.
What role has your cohort played in that, doing this as a cohort with other women?
Well, I've tried to quit 4 times. So when you have a cohort, though, it's you move kind of as one. So you, of course, are writing your own papers and taking your own tests, but you're kind of doing it together. So you have questions. What does this mean? I am a clay to my classmate, Amy, you know, Amy and Rebecca. But they kind of Sherpa me in a way because I don't understand instructions, or like Don so egregiously gives instructions that are about 3 pages long. And so some things get lost.
I'm just going to let that go. But go ahead.
I'm not used to several pages of instructions, but you start kind of remembering, okay, this is school and we're doing it this way. And so the cohort keeps you going, and the relationships that you build inside of your cohort, because it's small. I mean, it is small enough that you get to know everybody and they keep you going. And so you think, oh, I'm going to quit. But then you think, no, I'm not, because all my classmates and, or when they want to quit and you're like, over my dead body, not today. No. So it's kind of, I can't recommend it enough. It's not that you can't do it without a cohort, but this experience of a cohort makes it so much more rich.
You mentioned loving God more. How so?
I think I distilled the story in the Bible down to an uncomplicated, unlayered, just, it was flat. I think not flatness. My relationship with God is real and vibrant, and it was before this, but I think I distilled these stories into really simplistic things about God. And now with the context and even like we're doing New Testament right now. And I used to be like, Paul, you are something else. Like, you're not my favorite, and like, tone it down. Let's take it down. And now I'm reading more and getting the context and learning about his background and history. And I'm thinking, I think I want to be his best friend. And so it's just changing the way that I view God and view the Bible, and remember, like, oh, all these stories are so connected. All these stories are telling us something about God's character. And I didn't have such a robust understanding or reading of the Bible.
That's so well said. You must be a writer. You ought to write a book.
I did it. And now I only have the brain space to read. I was thinking when we went into the cohort, I was thinking Denver Seminary would be like, hey, you guys are doing some stuff. You're reading, you're writing, you're like preaching, maybe you're whatever. You're doing a lot of things. And so we're going to kind of go easy on you. And we are going to not make you cite things with the correct terabium. And I was not right. I was not right. It's a rigorous program. And you academic people care about your citations.
Well, we do. Yes, we do, as a matter of fact.
Because I learned
why,
that.
Why? Because we have no life.
Well,
and
I don't
that's all
say
we
it,
can care about. I know. But
yeah,
you did.
I didn't
well,
say it,
well but... on that note, Jamie, thanks. Thanks for spending time with us, and thanks for the work that you put in, and not just the work that you put in, but for putting yourself and your journey into this book. This Must Be the Place. I'll put in one more final plug for it. This Must Be the Place, following the breadcrumbs of your past to discover your purpose today. So if you don't have a copy, get yourself a copy of this thing, wherever
Do
you
it.
Get books. Jamie, thanks.
Thank you
Good
for having me.
You.
This was fun.
Friends, we're grateful to you as well for spending time with us. And if you get the chance, please leave us a rating or a review wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments, you can send those to us at podcast@denverseminary.edu. And you can also visit our website, denverseminary.edu, for more information, resources about Denver Seminary, advanced degree programs, and all the other episodes of Engage 360, including full transcripts, if you would like those. We're grateful for your interest, for your support, for your prayers, and hope you'll check back with us again very soon. So until then, may the Lord bless you and keep you. Take care.